This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here's Michael Miller, Associate Professor of Economics at DePaul University. Professor Miller, welcome back.
It's great to be with you again, John.
I was hopeful that maybe some of the market's negative reaction to a slight increase in the inflation rate would have already been baked in, that it might react, but not 1,200 points. Why did we lose so much on the Dow yesterday?
You know, that was, when I looked at the report, I just saw the 0.1% increase month over month, and I thought, oh, that's good news. I think that maybe inflation has in fact peaked, and I walked away. And then I looked at the market, I'm seeing a crash, and I had to figure out what in the heck went wrong. And I looked at it more deeply, and what changed was something called core inflation, which I think you've talked about before. And that's where you remove the very volatile sectors like food and energy, or it doesn't even have to be those. It can be anything that's an unusually large movement in any given month. And core inflation is actually what the Federal Reserve looks at when they're trying to decide what to do with monetary policy. And core was up a stunning 0.6%. Everybody expected. Now, these are just forecasts, and those forecasts are just people's guesses. But the forecast and what was built into the market was a 0.3% increase. So when you had double the increase in a time like this, when the Fed is trying to decide, are we going to continue to raise rates very aggressively? It seems for sure now, given this core number, that the Fed will, in fact, raise rates next week a full 0.75%. And I think that's what the market was reacting to.
You'd think that maybe the price of gas going down, fuel going down as much as it did, would have trickled through the CPI, that it would have actually made everything less expensive. I wonder why gas prices didn't pull these other core indexes down.
Well, it would take a while for those lower cost of gasoline to filter then into these other products. Because we did see in the monthly report that gas, used cars, and airfares all went down. That doesn't translate into, say, food going down or something else going down because transportation is cheaper. That could take several months. And what we see is this core inflation tries to gather what is called underlying inflation. What is the true direction of change in prices? And what we found was that food and medical, electricity and natural gas, all things that people buy, every single month, all were up last month. And the reason it was only a 0.1% increase is because the drop in gasoline prices was so substantial. Now, see, if the market is also looking forward, the chances that gasoline prices will fall an equal percentage amount in the next month is very small. We see that the price of fruit that was just reported is up towards $90 again, and therefore, there's a good chance that the drop in gasoline prices is over. There won't be an increase much, but there's probably the drop is over, which means those underlying prices are going to continue to rise. And I think, again, that's what the market's reacting to, this core idea.
So then the Fed's going to raise interest rates 75 basis points. So now...
Economists, of course, this is a social science. It's not a natural science. So a lot of it is based upon art instead of science. And there are really good economists on both sides of the argument. If you take Larry Summers, he thinks we need to move quickly and aggressively, and he's a brilliant man. But then you have a guy named like Joe Stiglitz, who's a Nobel Prize-winning economist, and he says he thinks the Fed should pause to make sure they don't make unemployment rise too quickly or too high. And I get his point, you know, because unemployment is so damaging to the households that it affects. So even economists, very bright economists, in both Stiglitz and Summers would be considered on the Democrat side or the left side of the political spectrum. They're split on exactly what the Fed should do, but the Fed seems of one mind. The Fed seems to believe that if they pause, like they did a couple times in the 1970s, it could lead to inflation becoming more ingrained in the economy.
Talk about this. We'll pause here for just a minute, and then I'll get your answer, Mike Miller. Is an economist over at DePaul University. So 0.6%. You described that number as stunning. It's double what they anticipated it would be. 0.6% is the increase in the cost of some of these core goods. Well, it's not 6 times the cost of these core goods. I know that double what we thought sounds alarming, and then the market reacts and the Fed reacts, but maybe everybody's overreacting. It's not like these things are suddenly absolutely unaffordable. Or are they? I know I speak from a position of comfort. I don't have to worry about those things. I don't have a large family. I make a nice living. But I wonder if maybe the numbers are jarring, but the reality isn't as bad as they make it sound. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, and we're talking with Michael Miller, Associate Professor of Economics at DePaul University. He was talking about the market's reaction to the increase in inflation yesterday. 0.6%, the rate went up on some of the core things that we buy, and that's why the market fell so much. Yeah, I wondered out loud a moment ago, Michael, if everybody's overreacting a little bit. What do you think about that?
Well, the number sounds so small, but we got to remember two things. One is this is in 1 month, prices went up that much. And here's the second one, and I think the one that would be weighing on the market. If you look at core prices over the past year, they've been up about 6.3%. And what you would hope is that the signs in the market today are that that rate of inflation is declining. So in other words, the additional months are showing that inflation is slowing. The unfortunate thing is if you take 0.6 and you annualize it, in other words, assume that it runs 0.6 every month for a year, you're talking about an inflation rate of 7.2 to 7.4%. So what you have is that the short run information regarding prices is actually a negative. It's showing a speed up in prices as opposed to a decline. And again, the market looks at these data and they'll look at the year over year, but they're also looking forward. And they're concerned that that 0.6, when annualized, is showing that the pressures today are actually greater than they were, say, a couple months ago.
Well,
and
do you,
that leads them to be concerned.
Do you think that it's going to continue at this rate, that it annualized will be 7.2%?
No, sometime back you had me on and I said I thought that prices would continue to rise through mid-2022, as we're a little bit beyond mid, and I'm still convinced that inflation has peaked and it's going to go down, but it's going to be a little more slowly than I thought. So I'm not greatly concerned with this one number. I was a little surprised. But you know that the one thing is that electricity and gas, natural gas prices have really been such a weight on the average household.
Oh.
You know, you look at the things that are hitting the people, it really hurts in the pocketbook. Even though people are getting pretty decent raises, when you adjust it for inflation, our incomes are down about 3% year over year.
Hmm.
And I saw a number, I thought it was, you can actually kind of, it becomes real to a regular household who has a budget. If you were to consider the basket of goods that is in the CPI, you had to buy it a year ago, and then you had to buy it today. That same basket of goods today costs $460 more than it did a year ago. And now, unless you got at least a $460 increase in a month, that's where the people are hurting. So I think that the households are being a burden by what's happening with this inflation. And it's every household. It's not just some. It's not like unemployment affects only those who are unemployed. Inflation affects everybody.
Hmm. Yeah, at least the dollar is more valuable if you're traveling. I guess that's small consolation to people who can't afford groceries. They're probably not going to go to Paris, but what's happening there and what does that mean?
Yeah, you know, that most people don't watch the value of the dollar unless they're somehow speculating to try to make money off it. But, you know, as we have problems in the U.S., I mean, our labor market is second to none, but with inflation being high and GDP growing very slowly, you know, a lot of the rest of the world is in worse shape than we are. And what we see is that the value of the dollar compared to Europe and other trading partners is at a 20-year high. Now, what that means to the average household is somewhat limited, but it's real. First off, if you do want to travel, everything is much cheaper overseas. But anything that you buy that is an import from another country is going to have, over time, a price which is lower, because they're willing to take fewer dollars because each dollar they accept is worth more than it was before. Now, this does, however, put a negative side on people who are trying to export. So it'd be really good if you're trying to, say, buy a car from Europe, or you're trying to buy air conditioning equipment or something like that. But if you want to sell them something from you, their currencies aren't worth as much, and you're going to have to charge them more. So yeah, there's a plus side and a negative side when it comes to the strength of the dollar.
Bad news for my friends in Peoria at Caterpillar Inc., yes, then, who are trying to sell tractors all around the world or in Europe. I see your point.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. And, there is one good thing, though. You know, you wonder, why would the dollar be so strong? It has to do, there's something called fundamentals. That's interest rates and relative inflation rates and so forth. But there's some work coming out of one gentleman, I think at the Brookings Institute. And he argues that the dollar is strong because we're more innovative than the rest of the world. And that would be a really, if he's correct, that's a really good sign, because that means that we will become more competitive and more productive going forward, and that would be very positive for the long-run growth of the American economy. So I'm kind of hoping he is right in his analysis, that it's not caused solely by changes in interest rates or changes in inflation. It is the underlying strength of the American economy relative to places in Europe. You know, Germany's in big trouble.
Yeah.
Britain's in very big trouble. Oh, my gosh. The issues they have in Britain with very high inflation and closing businesses and so forth. So we have troubles, but a lot of the rest of the world has bigger troubles, and that's showing up in the value of the dollar.
And I'd like to think it would be a reflection not just of the American economy, but the American ethos, the American spirit, that we're more innovative, as you said. Maybe we're just better. I don't know if you buy that, but maybe there's
I'm sorry. Yeah, I do, in fact, because, you know, there's these fundamentals can only explain part of the movement of a currency. There's got to be something of, am I willing to hold dollars? And, you know, in any time there's a crisis in the world, people flow to two things or three things. They flow to gold. They put their money into U.S. dollars, and they put their money into U.S. Treasuries, because the dollar and the gold and the
treasuries,
relative to other, you know, assets in the world, are the safest place to be. And I think that's a reflection of the underlying stability of the American economy, say, compared to these other countries.
Michael Miller,
like to see that.
Associate Professor of Economics over at DePaul. Michael, I could go all day, but they won't let me.
I could, too. I just love talking about this stuff. And I appreciate you having me on, John.
He's good at it. That's Michael Miller. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. Dale Buss joins us now, veteran financial journalist, founder and executive director of the Flyover Coalition. He talks about businesses that impact the Midwest, and he's especially astute, maybe as a result of that, about the auto business and the big auto show. The big car show is going on in Detroit. Is that where you are today, Dale?
Yeah, absolutely, John. I mean, not to mention, I spent decades covering the auto industry for Wall Street Journal and a bunch of other publication. So one of the most exciting events of the year, being located in Detroit as a journalist, was traditionally to go to the Detroit Auto Show, which until and through 2019, there were as many as 7,000, 8,000 journalists, producers, hangers-on, TikTok influencers, you name it, who came here and just swarmed here for a couple or 3 days of interviews, dozens of press conferences by auto brands from all over the world, suppliers, tech people, you name it, they were here. And 3 years later, or 3.5 years, it's just a whole different vibe. I mean, I just went through the security checkpoint. The Secret Service was searching everyone because Joe Biden is here somewhere. He's going to talk about his environmental program and Progress and EV credits and all that. So there's a little bit of a buzz about that, but, you know, overall, the place is way different. And part of that's, you know, we can talk about the nature of auto shows and how it's changed. And it should be mentioned that the Chicago show, which is still the biggest, if not, you know, certainly one of the biggest in the world, is being afflicted by some of the same factors that we can discuss.
Well, are you describing the auto show then as less attended, fewer cars, fewer people? It's downsizing?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, it's downsized. I mean, what happened even before COVID was that companies kind of took a page from, you know, how Apple has the big stage with Tim Cook up there talking about product releases and apps and new versions of iPhones and all that. Well, the auto business has kind of taken a clue from that over the last several years and decided to do many more of their own one-off presentations and model reveals. And so what used to happen at all these shows was there were literally dozens of reveals of new models and features that companies would tout. Well, now they're like, okay, everybody come to California. We're going to do our own intro, or they'll do it online only. So literally now here, the only real significant intros have been by the big three Detroit automakers. Like Ford is unveiling its new Mustang, not the electric one, the gas powered one. And Jeep has something going on, Chevy as well, but there's no Toyota. There's no Hyundai. There's
not
none
even
of
there.
The big German.
Are you saying
well,
Toyota?
Well, I mean, they've got representation. Toyota's got a booth, but they don't have a press conference. They don't have anything in particular to create buzz or to draw journalists or to brag about. In fact, what I noticed this morning, to add insult to injury, is that three of the companies that are not making press announcements at the Detroit show actually put out their own news releases about new models. Just happened to be on the day of press days at the auto show. Honda and Toyota and Lexus all did that. So, you know, the vibe here is very different. It's sad in a big way. I mean, it's part of an industry that's undergoing so much transition. And that's why Biden is here, of course, to tout electric vehicles and federal policies. But it's interesting. It's just kind of starting to reveal itself to me.
What about the electric cars then? If those are the focus or maybe the stars of the show this year,
absolutely.
What are you seeing or what are they showing?
Well, everybody's got something electric. I mean, it's just kind of the coin of the realm, right? You have to have electric vehicles. Jeep, which was very late to the EV game, is coming out with hybrid versions of some of its popular models like the Wrangler. And so that's a big draw at the show. But everybody has to kind of pay the piper in terms of showing off their current electric models and hybrids, or especially future models. And, you know, with President Biden coming here to talk about the importance of EVs, the EVs absolutely dominate. So that is a marked difference from 2019, when it was still kind of like, we still like gas-powered cars, and here's a few EVs. There's also less of an emphasis this year on automated safety features and autonomous driving, which 3-4 years ago was a pipe dream that, you know, was supposed to be basically reality by now, but of course it isn't. So companies aren't doing as much emphasis on that. It's all about electric.
I'm wondering if you think that the auto industry is shooting itself in the foot here by not working in concert and having a big 3-day show with all of the makers displaying new things and creating some buzz. You know, there's only one Apple. If they do a launch, everybody pays attention. There's not 100 different kinds of phones to buy out there, but there's 100 different car makers out there. I think they would be better off if they stuck together.
Well, you make an absolutely great point. In fact, that was the reigning philosophy for decades. And not only did they make a big buzz and impression with the global news media, but auto shows attracted, you know, tens, sometimes 100,000 consumers in a local market, like Detroit or Chicago.
Yeah.
That's just not as much the case now. Again, marketing has changed. Auto companies have decided it's really expensive to put exhibits here and bring all their execs here. You know, let's do something online. Let's have a TikTok theme. Let's do something on social media. Let's have an event, invite a couple dozen reporters, Chicago or whatever, we'll reveal something. The other thing that's changed, the pandemic, obviously, but also the supply chain issue. So,
yeah, well,
you know, you only want to try so hard to sell vehicles that you don't have in supply in your dealerships anyway.
Really?
so it's all really about the future. You know, what are we going to see once supply chains get straightened out? And no one knows exactly when that's going to happen.
You know, maybe then they will grow more. I'm anxious for these things to come back. I enjoy going to the one in Chicago, and I also think it's good for the industry. But, yeah, you got to have vehicles to sell. Dale Buss is a veteran financial journalist. He's the founder and executive director of the Flyover Coalition. I'm out of time, but maybe let's talk again sometime soon about that show, the shows, and for that matter, the one in Chicago in February. February, right? Is that when our show is? February? All right. Thank you, Dale. Good to talk to you, sir. You bet.
Right.
Stay well. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. More business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. University of Chicago Medicine has announced plans to acquire a portion of Advent Health to expand care and services in the western suburbs. The proposed affiliation would give the hospital a controlling interest in Advent Health's Great Lakes region, including hospitals in Bolingbrook, Glendale Heights, Hinsdale, and LaGrange. The deal also covers primary and specialty practice locations and two ambulatory centers in Carroll Stream and Woodridge. Pending regulatory approvals, the plan should be finalized by the end of the year. U Chicago has declined to disclose the purchase price. Baxter International is considering divesting two units of its flagship renal care business. This according to a report by Bloomberg, quoting people familiar with the matter. The units are expected to be valued at under $1 billion. Baxter's Renal Care Services operates dialysis clinics and generates about $250 million in annual revenue. The hemodialysis business makes machines that filter blood and generates about $1 billion in annual revenue. The Deerfield-based medical device company is working with advisors on the potential sales. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Time for the business of food. Here's Steve Alexander.
And we're sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. This is a big weekend in Chicago. The Green Tie Ball is back after COVID interruptus. The Ball's the annual fundraiser for Gateway Green, the public-private partnership, which has beautified dozens of expressway interchanges with landscaping and art. And I'll get to that in a moment. But what stands out about the Green Tie Ball is what a hookup event it has been.
Chicago Magazine once wrote that more people have met each other and gotten married because of the Green Tie Ball than any other event in the city.
Grant DePorter is chairman of Chicago Gateway Green, and here's the business of food part.
CEO of Harry Carey's Restaurant Group and founder of the Chicago Sports Museum.
Which is where the Green Tie Ball will be Saturday night.
And the Chicago Sports Museum created our theme. So the theme this year is tuxedos and tennis shoes.
But let's go back to the beginning. Grant's late father, Don DePorter, ran all the Hyatt hotels in the Midwest.
And he would hear from all the visitors coming to Chicago, and they would all talk about the Kennedy being just mud, litter, graffiti, nothing green anywhere. And this was going back to the early 80s. So in 1986, he founded Chicago Gateway Green. It's dedicated to beautifying and greening Chicago's expressways, gateways, and neighborhoods through landscape enhancement, graffiti and litter removal, and the installation of public art.
Don passed away in 1996, so he didn't get to see what a success Gateway Green has become.
So we have about 150 expressway gardens, Chicagoland's expressway system, and over the last 36 years, we planted thousands of trees, bushes, and shrubs, and picked up somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million pounds of litter.
And it's gone beyond cleaning up expressways.
We've also done a reading garden next to the public library in Englewood. We transformed a children's playground at a school called El Valor in South Chicago, and it looks now like a mini Chicago Bears football field.
The Green Tie Ball to benefit the beautification of Chicago via Gateway Green, Saturday night at the Chicago Sports Museum in Watertower Place Mall. Free food and booze from Harry Carey's restaurant.
You get tickets by going to gatewaygreen.org.
And who knows?
We've had marriages during the Green Tie Ball.
From the farm to your belly, today's National Cream-Filled Donut Day. It's also National Eat a Hoagie Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
You know, only one Mexican-born chef has received a Michelin star, and that chef is Carlos Gaitan from Zuco here in Chicago. As we are very close to Mexican Independence Day, they're putting together a special dinner to celebrate that. A five-course meal. Chef Carlos, welcome. How are you?
Great, great. Thank you for the invitation. I mean, amazing to be part of this.
Well, congratulations on your success at 720 North State in River North, celebrating your third anniversary. So September 15th, what's the special? What are you serving up, Chef?
Well, first of all, you know, I'm going to buy five different chefs. We're going to have a tasty menu. I'm going to have Claudette Cepeda, that she's the one on an Iron Chef right now. We have Ivan Musharraf. He's a chef from Baja California. It's called Chileno Hotel. Javier Plasencia, he is from Valle Guadalupe as well. He's a very well-known chef over there. We have Juan Gutierrez, a pastry chef that he just won a chocolate competition and a Food Network. And obviously, it's going to be me. So all of us, we're going to put a menu together. A tasty menu. It's going to be five courses for everyone.
I see. So each of the chefs takes on one of the courses, the five chefs you just mentioned. So just humor me. What are some of the foods I'm going to taste?
Well, Claudette is going to do it with tlacoche tlacoya with tuna and some Oaxacan beans. So it's going to be really well-balanced dish. Ivan is going to be with the second course, going to do pescado zarandeado with real avocado, tomatoes, raisins, calites, and botaga. So it'll be a very amazing. Chef Plasencia will be doing a smoky rice with green gravy and pork chorizo, Harlem beans, arborio rice, and Pacific mussels. Myself, I'm going to do an American coffee with black brioche, burnt onion puree, black trumpets, mushrooms, and smoked Japanese onion powder. And our chef, Juan Gutierrez, who's in charge of the dessert, is going to do coco five different ways.
So a chocolate dessert. So then I buy a ticket for this dinner. It's $180, and a wine pairing can also be added to the experience. So it's a sit-down dinner, these five different courses served, if I'm reading that correctly, huh?
That's correct.
Wow.
Yeah, we open the doors at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Are there still seats available? Can I still go?
Yeah, you can still come in. We have just only a few spaces available early and a couple are very late. Most of between is being sold out, yeah.
4 to 10 p.m. Monday through Thursday is when you're open. This is going to be on Thursday, so 4 to 10 p.m., are those the hours then?
That's correct.
All right. Actually, I said it's going to be Thursday. It's going to be on Thursday, if I'm not mistaken, right? Thursday of this week.
Yes, Thursday.
Okay. All right. Listen, I want to go. I'm out of time, though. It's nice to talk to you, Chef. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I'm looking forward to see you be here.
They're presenting a special five-course dinner Thursday, September 15th, over at Zuko.